everyone's attention, I think we can probably get out to a reasonable hour. As you know, I tried to visit everybody, and there's always that limitation of coming in at an awkward time, so I don't know what happened before or after I left. But a couple of things that I want to communicate about not just what I saw today, but what I'm seeing in general, the areas that you might want to think about. And I gave some of these to your group, Wei, but I'm going to just repeat it. So, I want to make sure that when you're mediating, that you feel, and the people with whom you are mediating feel, that you're making an emotional connection. Some of the time, I'm feeling a little bit too much like what I'm seeing is somebody who is communicating, this is another day at the office. If you are dealing in particular with these kinds of cataclysmic moments in people's lives, and you do not convey to them that your being in the moment is comparable to the extent to which they are in the moment, which I guarantee you is exclusively in the moment, you're not going to have much credibility with them. And everything that you do in terms of the way you speak, the way you make eye contact, the way you're positioned in a chair, the tone of your voice, the sense that you're not worrying about, you know, I've got to meet Joe Blow at such and such later on in the day, or that your body language isn't as someone's was last week. No names, but we had, if you recall, like a five-person mediation, and we had one of the people was sort of sitting at not the end of the table, but at the end of a side of the table, and was kind of looking away from the people and biting their nails. That ain't gonna work. You know, there are no rules, but I think we all know that that's not an issue of rules, that's an issue of common sense. You're asking for people in crisis to trust you, and they're not gonna trust you if they don't think you're really there for them. Now, the part of the sort of central part of the mediation that I heard most of was in Shauna's group, and I think Shauna did make that contact. I felt that you conveyed that it was important to you that you be there and that you were engaged and that you cared. I also saw that she repeatedly made acknowledging statements, thanking people for their contributions, acknowledging their contributions, making it clear that she wasn't somebody who knew all the answers, and that she wanted to hear from them and would validate the fact of their feelings without judging those feelings. And that kind of persona, or that kind of beingness in the situation, is really very, very important. So that was sort of item number one. Item number two is, I'm not sure whether any of the mediators to date have yet begun by in any way explaining the mediation process. Chelsea.
Oh, I was going to say, because that's one thing that I think is so important. But I feel like Steve did that last.
Steve did it last week.
Yeah.
Today,
yeah.
Again, I wasn't there for the beginnings of any of them. Well, a little bit for Tania's, but I'm just wondering. I think I indicated it's delicate in clinical mediations how you handle this, because it's not a problem in most legal and commercial mediations to take a fair amount of time if you determine in your own view that it would be useful to give a fairly long introduction. And in fact, I have, over the years that I've been mediating, making my introductions longer rather than shorter, because I now find that I can predispose people to the value of the process by talking to them about all kinds of things that they may never have considered about the nature of human disputes. But the problem is, in a hospital setting, very often the people may not want to listen to that. And I think I even mentioned that one of the commentators in the book actually goes and says, don't scare them by telling them a lot about how you're there to help them reach a consensual resolution to their dispute if they don't know they have a dispute. Mm-hmm. Then that may actually churn it up more than it has to be churned. So you have to be sensitive to the lay of the land at the outset. But I do think, in more cases than not, you want them to know, at least, that you're not there to make a decision, that you're there to help them reach a consensual resolution and tell them what consensual means. All right? And even if that's all you're going to do, that's something that may help. Now, another thing that you always are dealing with, and you know this by now, is that tough decision as to when to caucus, when not to caucus, timing-wise and in terms of individuals. And it was interesting because in Amy's group, and we talked about this, Corbett was the risk manager, and somehow he ended up being sort of boxed out of the mediation because he was asked to leave for a substantial period of time, and they never really addressed his issues. Now, I don't know whether that was because, and Amy, you know, herself volunteered that she didn't think his issues were all that important. But I guess maybe Corbett didn't communicate how important they were to him. But obviously, even if we assume that Corbett, as the risk manager, had concerns that were, let's say, not at the center of the issues that were being determined in the mediation, the fact that they were a little bit of the tail wagging the dog probably meant that, as Amy indicated, that would have been a better idea for her to caucus with him, to find out what his concerns were and how serious those concerns were. Because obviously he has a responsibility to the hospital. He wouldn't be at this mediation if he didn't think there were patient safety and staff safety issues. All right. So again, this question of who do I meet with, when do I meet with them, is something that's always a live issue and you have to be thinking about. Another thing that I had an opportunity to discuss a little bit in Amy's group, because they finished earlier, was this important question of thinking about the larger reasons for why we mediate in the first place. And the fact that I think we often make a wrong assumption. We often think very narrowly that the focus of the mediation is to get the outcome, period. Now, think about this for a minute. Every time you go into that room, there's always going to be either a definite or a probable person in that room who has the power to make the decision, irrespective of what we do as mediators and irrespective of the people who don't have that power. What I want you to realize is that there's a much broader motivating force going on here, which is, irrespective of who would make the decision in the event of no consensual agreement, hospitals are rightly not in the business of attempting to alienate a maximum number of people. And part of the healing process, defined more globally, isn't just to heal the disease, but it is rather to bring this constellation of people around the patient and the constellation of people in the caregiver group into a position where they can feel that they are participating and being part of a dialogue about this entire healthcare process. Even if we don't reach consensus, there's a chance that the mere fact of having invited them into the room and given them a position at the table is enough of an improvement of recognition versus dismissiveness to make people less hostile and alienated than they otherwise would be. And indeed, the reality is that there will frequently be a group of people in that mediation room, only one of whom has the power to make the decision. And what you're trying to find out is whether the interests of those not empowered people, who when you give them the opportunity to engage in that dialogue, express themselves in a protected way, meaning they're not going to be attacked, they're not going to be emotionally vilified by the process, and they're not going to be judged by the mediator, will then be able to find a way of reaching a consensual agreement that in fact is consistent with the decision maker's ability to perform that decision making function. In other words, despite the fact that I'm not the decision maker, I might, in my dialogue with the decision maker, be able to find that we have enough common ground that he or she can imagine making a decision that also comports with my value system. Now, it's not always going to work. And in fact, it isn't even always as simple as what I just said, because we know there are also conflicts in which it's going to go to the next level, to wit, there's going to be an argument about who the decision maker is. You know, to wit, is there a advance directive? Is the advance directive valid, or can it be knocked out for some reason? If it's not valid, is the person going to go to court to try to have it overturned? If the person who has the power to make the decision, is that power something that is given to them by an advance directive in absolute sense, or are they subject to functioning as a list of people in a succession of surrogates, again, in a state statute that says, okay, now the daughter is up because, I don't know, the parent, whatever, whoever second is the one to make the decision. She's there, she's going to make the decision. But does that statute in that state also tell that surrogate what criteria she has to use? Maybe it does, and maybe it doesn't. Depends on the state. And so what you as a mediator might also be doing in that situation, knowing full well, right, who the decision maker is and what criteria she is if she's acting in accordance with what the statute requires, that you may help inject into that dialogue those criteria so that the people who are both the decision makers and not empowered decision makers understand what the default position is. In other words, Victoria is the designated decision maker, and she's told by the statute that what she must do is attempt to adduce evidence of what the patient would have likely done by herself if she were competent and present and able to make the decision. So then, if you know that that's true, and the competing, if you will, party urging an outcome different than what Victoria is urging at the table might learn a great deal if you began to stimulate a dialogue that turned on the criteria that the statute presents. And that may help that other person to understand whether, even if they had the power, is their point of view the point of view that would be likely to be given credence by the institution and the courts. And if not, might that lead them to reconsider? Not that you're telling them that their position is wrong, but you're explaining to them the power calculus here and how it will really work. So again, don't be under the impression that when you're mediating, your sole goal is, I'm here to make sure that we reach agreement, because if we don't reach agreement, the world is going to come to an end. No, what's going to happen is that the people who are not in power will react, in all likelihood, very negatively to that exercise of power by the person who is designated, but having the person exercising that power with a complete dismissal of all the other countervailing points of view, right? So I want you to look at that in that much, much broader context. Can anybody give me some examples of issues that occurred in your particular group that you think are worth discussing with the larger group? Steve?
One thing that I thought was interesting in our group was the way that we ended up sitting around. And I think it's probably like fairly similar to how it would be in a hospital.
Right.
But like the mediator was sort of seated a little bit back in like a chair.
Right.
And I think Richard was a little bit kind of off on his own, on his like king's throne, as it
right.
were.
Right. right.
And I think just like the seating arrangement kind of split people further into factions in some way.
Okay. And what would you have rather seen?
I mean,
I thought about this actually.
Yeah. But okay.
I definitely, if I had been the mediator, I would have directed you to sit next to me on one side and had the wife on the other, so that you can have a conversation back and forth, but have them separated, without having, just because he was so far off, and it seemed like everyone was talking at him.
Yeah.
Whereas if you could turn and talk like this, it's a little bit more congenial, where he had that with basically no one.
And these are these are the so-called shape of the table issues that you read about as being so high profile in diplomatic negotiations, but can be equally significant in any negotiation. Yeah. So that's a point well taken. Another thing, if I can jump in, I still want to hear from more of you, but I wanted to remember that in Amy's group, it was very interesting that I didn't expect this, but one of the things that the doctors did in order to gain the confidence of Mr. Thomas was to agree, or even volunteer, I guess, rather than just agree, to be with Mr. Thomas in the act of prayer. That was a very powerful thing. I mean, it is fairly common, as I heard in other of your groups, to recommend and implement the idea of bringing a chaplain in, and that's often a very useful tool. But this idea that these doctors were volunteering to, you know, actually be there and affirm their respect for Mr. Thomas's religious beliefs, even though they were not necessarily consistent with their own, has the potential to be a very, very powerful thing. And I thought that was creative and very useful. And
I think it ties to what Dave said. Steve said, and Dave both said. You know, I think that Richard's personality was, he seemed like because he was already upset, and then he seemed to be attention seeking. So it seemed like he he was being enabled in a way, you know, the way he sat, he was being, like, it was like an interrogation session in a way.
Right.
So, you know, and the fact that he liked the tension, with, you know, with that role, so he wants to really keep, you know, getting at everybody, so.
But
and that was the role he had, though.
It was the role Dick had, but yeah. It was also, if you think about it, Dick was partly in that mode because he was that character,
exactly. But
that character had the problem of having essentially been at arm's length from his daughter for 6 years, and dealing perhaps with guilt associated with that, and with a sense of not of having to make up for lost time that he was now being told he could never make up for. Now, if you don't let him vent and put that out there on the table, not just, you know, to say it, drop it in there, but to really do it the way he did it, I think you're going to lose him. I think it was okay to let him go, and I also think that it was right for Shauna when Dick said, I want an outside opinion. Why not? Why not? Now, if in fact that outside opinion couldn't be logistically accomplished before the second brain scan, you still could have that person come in, somebody who was agreeable to everybody, may come in and be told by the physician who did the second brain scan, here are the results. He goes and says, look, Mr. Thomas, you know, I'm very sorry to tell you this, but no matter what I do, and I could do 40 of these scans, but, you know, your daughter is in fact brain dead, and explain that brain dead is dead. Brain dead is not, some way of torturing the language to talk about death that isn't really death. It's death. And so maybe, just having that guy come in and sit with Dick, put his hand on Dick's arm and look him in the eye and say, there really isn't, you know, another option, there isn't another test, might have done it. Worst case scenario, you do an extra scan. You know, I mean, it's not the end of the world. So it seems to me, yes, Dick.
One thing I'm curious, though, is that this guy was basically taking his head out for a walk. And in that sort of situation, as a mediator, how do you decide how and when to sort of just set limits?
To rein him in?
Yeah, because I mean, I kept going and pushing, and nobody really pushed back, really.
She set some limits.
Okay.
Yeah, when most of the...
I called him more several times.
I wasn't there the whole time, but... when you were talking...
I do get around.
when you were in caucus with Shauna, I don't think there's any problem at all letting you vent. When you get back into the room, it might have been possible for Shauna to put a little bit more of a control.
But how do you do that without setting somebody off and just making it worse? That's what I'm, because I didn't know what to do or how to do it, but also I realized I was being very inappropriate.
Right. I think the way you do it, or one way of doing it, is either in the first caucus, or if necessary, in another caucus, that she could have a dialogue with you about what makes this process effective and how it has worked during the umpteen years that she's done it. And that while she fully understands that you're the one who has the most emotional stake in this, that actually for your own benefit, we all know what it is that we know and what we feel, but to the extent we're going to try to create this consensual resolution, we got to learn what the other people think, or we're only here to spin our wheels, that kind of thing. And she can do that in a very humane way and in a very, a positive way with you. And I think you could do that because you're good at it. Yes, Lisa.
Along the same line, so you know, Dick was very focused, or the father was very focused on, you know, not the trust. The trust was a huge issue with the group,
yep.
Whereas his wife was focused on his daughter dying with dignity. And so...
Which is a classic.
Right, but how do you... So if you have very different goals for the patient, and, you know, the mother is ready to just let go. She's ready. She's, you know, she's had her, you know, peace, said, you know, with her daughter. She's ready to let go.
Right.
How do you get to that point where you do meet halfway? I mean, I said this in our group. I felt like we were really focusing on Dick, and I didn't know if we really had met, you know, the okay. wife's goals, or whether just gave in to, like, you know...
Let me. It's a great question. I hope that the answer is in part embedded in the Solbach article that I assigned, which, and I know you weren't here last week, but I told you that I wanted to address that issue of the classical origins. This whole idea of addressing ethical issues in a situation where you have multiple parties with different value systems, articulating legitimate points of view that nonetheless are not susceptible of convincing the other to alter to meet yours, was always dealt with in Greek philosophy, in Plato and in Socrates and others, by addressing ethical or morally aporetic issues via the dialogue itself, meaning, as Solbach says, the teacher does not tell the people what is the right thing or the wrong thing. It is the dialogue with the cross-examination, called the elenchus in Greek, that challenges the parties to explicate and rethink their own factual and moral assumptions. And that dialogue takes place for long enough and with enough intensity that what ideally will happen is that these parties will not change their minds, but they will recognize something else, which is, I now understand that Mary's point of view, while diametrically opposed to mine, is in fact deeply held, deeply felt, and has legitimacy, meaning it is expressed to articulate a point of view that is morally defensible. Different, but defensible. Your issue, Lisa. Quality of life, dignity, and so on, over here. Your issue, whoever is on the father's issue. Longevity, do everything you can to make her live as long as possible, and in fact, give her the opportunity to experience a miracle. Religious concept. You can't say that either of those are morally deficient notions. They're legitimate points of view. That's why this idea of having clinical ethics consultants opine on and direct the correct resolution in a morally aporetic situation makes no sense. How could I, or again, I don't like to dump on Art, but Art Kaplan is the guru, how can Art Kaplan say that he knows better than you or better than me whether to choose this morally defensible position or this one? What happens if you really bring about a consciousness of that competing moral legitimacy? You increase the likelihood of gaining consensus, because remember, as soon as you see that this isn't me, the right-thinking guy, against the heathen, we have a totally different tenor. Katzen.
Something I
thought about would be like what the physician would be thinking in terms of her responsibility to dispel the misinformation, or basically Mr. Thomas's thoughts on the likelihood that a miracle would occur. That's like where I kind of got caught up. Like if a patient is declared brain dead, how likely is it that Maria is going to come back to the...
Right, now you're talking specifically about this case.
Yeah.
And I agree that in this case, once we have a definitive diagnosis of brain dead, the idea of giving the father the ability to somehow input with success the notion of continued treatment of a dead person, I think that's beyond the pale. It's true. But let me say, having said that, you still have the opportunity in the mediation to begin to have the father begin to comprehend why this was. Let's say that brain dead was not definitive here. You still have the opportunity to reach the father about comprehending the legitimacy of the mother's point of view, which may change his relationship to the entire dialogue. See, once you create mutual respect from pure antipathy, you have a different floor, a completely different baseline. And you'd be surprised at how effective this can be in the hands of a gifted mediator. Not going to happen 100% of the time. It's not always apposite to the situation, which, if you will remember, despite what it says in the books, most of these disputes are not about that. You know, they're about much more mundane things. But when they're not about much more mundane things, there is this whole issue that, it to me, is the core issue of what's stopping right now clinical healthcare mediation from already being universal, which is, and I've mentioned this to you before, you got clinical ethicists in hospitals, either connected to hospital ethics committees or independent of them. And those are the people who are in the role or designated as the providers of the clinical ethics consultations. Very few of these people have any meaningful training or experience in mediation. So if we say to these people, oh, by the way, and there's plenty of literature out there that agrees with us meaning myself, Autumn, Art, and all the other people who are on our side of this argument, that in fact, the idea of top-down authoritarian decisions about truly ethical issues is essentially, it's oxymoronic. It doesn't make any sense. It isn't possible. And so when they come back to trying to create credentialing and training requirements for clinical ethicists that put a huge component in there of bioethics principles, bioethics literature, blah, 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 and then say on the other side, well, and they have to have these interpersonal skills, which includes or can include mediation, blah, 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 that's an invitation to maintain the status quo. That, in other words, the turf that's being protected is the turf of the people who have the traditional skill set. That 50-year-old woman or man in that position doesn't want to be told tomorrow by the Center for Bioethics or ASBH or the National Working Group for Training and Credentialing, oh, by the way, you got to go back to school. And by the way, not only do you have to go back to school, but this isn't the kind of thing, guys, where if you take a course and you do two mediations, you're going to be an expert at it. And in fact, even if you take all the courses in the world, and even if you do a lot of them, you may not really have in you the wherewithal to do this kind of work. So that 50 or 60 year old person sitting there in the hospital doesn't want to hear, go back to school, and by the way, even if you go back to school, you may stink at this. I hate to be blunt, but that is exactly the way I see where we are at this point in time.
And could you also say that the very talented, naturally skilled mediator doesn't even really need schooling in a sense? If they're an experienced professional in a healthcare-related field, couldn't it be possible that they don't need schooling?
Anything's possible, Kadzi, and certainly there's
no... I think that would be another challenge, is people feeling like they're already qualified.
You know what? There'd be few and far between who... I would put it a different way. Let's suppose we have three people. This one has fabulous innate ability. This one has average innate ability. This one has no potential whatsoever. The bottom line is, we can, through both training and experience, all become better than what we are. So that's why I say, and this is even true in the non-medical context when I'm teaching my negotiation and dispute resolution courses at the Wharton School, I'm not here to say, you, after this course, are going to be better than her. I'm here to say you're going to be better or closer to what you can be than you were before you started. And that's just because you're going to become immersed in the situation instead of just being the prodigy.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah, it's just hard to quantify how...
Very hard to quantify, which is what makes it scary. You know, it's very hard to quantify. Because you may start out at a position that's way, way higher than, you know, the other people, and you actually might be able to do as good a job intuitively as somebody who has had 9 courses. And so this whole issue of training and credentialing, which is just in the early phases, I mean, you can even track, by the way, it's boring, so I wouldn't,
Yeah, but I think that argument is flawed because you see, I mean, in a lot of fields, that's also the case.
Like in education, like teachers. And there's problems right now, so I think
During the first class, I gave an example of violinists. I mean, absolutely, there's no doubt about it, but I think the problem is, remember, it's contextual. The problem is that they think that they is the status, people in the status quo. They think they already have the skill set. And so what they want to do is defend the notion that in these morally aporetic situations, they've got access to the answer. What's that?
Defending their position.
Right. And if this argument about moral aporia and about moral dialogue as articulated in Socrates, in Plato, I'm sorry, as in Plato in particular, is correct. What they're saying is a morally aporetic situation is one in which people have reached a stalemate in which there is sort of no way of going forward. And the only thing that can be done then is to allow the dialogue to become the healer. And the teacher is the facilitator. I mean, this is as though, you know, it's interesting because, Shauna, you're talking about the narrative medical ethics. Look at the obvious linkage between that notion and general mediation theory. This idea that we're going to create a dialogue in which everybody gets to vent and to talk about both their intellectual and emotional positions on any given issue, and that what's going to come out of that is the realization, not that there's a correct answer, but that we have to live together, which is the way it's phrased a lot of times in the Greek, and in other iterations, including narrative medical ethics, where what they say in narrative medical ethics is
what we can do is not have a dialogue in which the determination of the outcome goes to an individual designated to dictate it, but rather by a myriad of people, meaning all of the parties who are invested, find a way of achieving consensus so that they can go on living together and functioning, right? And then again, I think a lot of the reason why some of the arguments against are specious is because they forget about what we just said a half an hour ago, which is we're not pretending this is a panacea. We're not pretending we're going to get consensus in every case. What we're saying is, how can you deny people the opportunity to approach consensus where, if they don't, it's automatically going to be the case that only one of the interested parties gets heard and the others merely get dismissed? So, makes sense? Okay, I got to give you guys not next week's, because of course I won't see you for a couple of weeks. The midterm has been put on the computer, and it went on at 4:30 this afternoon on the blackboard. And this is for the next class. Elizabeth, a couple of people left. I should have given them. Dave,
I'm not here.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. You're not here. In this case, we're just going to double up.
I'm sorry.
But keep it.
Okay.
Keep it for yourself.
Yeah, thank you.
Chelsea, did she leave too?
Yes.
Can anybody give Chelsea hers? No? Anybody? No, Chelsea? I mean, we'll send it. And Christina? Katie? Did Katie go?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Katie's down there. Lisa? Dan, Mesa, Steve, Roberto, Tanaya,
Adams. All right.
I was the nurse.
Rebecca.
I was the nurse.
I get pretty much. I wonder if we're just on the same location.
Victoria.
I can take hers.
Which can you take? You can take hers. Okay.
Yeah.
And did I give you yours?
Yes.
Okay. What is that, yours, or is that someone?
No, that's she left too.
Oh, that's right. Does anybody know Elizabeth well enough to give it to her? Katrina and Paul.
Last but not least.
Oh no!
All right.
That's why I ordered for.
That's a good question.
We were talking about it. I could really get an out-of-the-box idea.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know if I'm that good.
But have you tried to just go through the syllabus?
I did.
And use...
Did you want to meet with us?
Yeah, maybe you should talk to them first. Okay. And then...
I didn't know if it sounded like so long.
Are you in social work?
No, but I prefer.
This is a good. is become familiar with both the original NSBH core competencies. There is an email dialogue going on now in ASBH because they're proposing to create credentialing and training qualifications. People are tearing each other apart.
I guess I'm thinking it would have to proceed or even like it would have to have similar time.
What do you think?
Right. I'm very interested in the system.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you just read, it's huge. I mean, there are already like 250 pages on this dialogue. But if you just read pieces of it, you'll almost be able to get your issues focused. If you send me an email, I will give you the access information.
And I'm still not totally clear on how bioethics and everything feel about the